gentlemen, get loud as we welcome our keynote speaker, Mr. Mick Ebeling.
Thank you, guys. This is amazing. I live in Los Angeles, so you got to figure it's still like 6:45 in the morning right now. I cannot tell you how fired up I am to be here with you guys today. So thank you guys for having me. Let's just jump right in. So this whole thing about impossible, for me, I'm infatuated with this concept of impossible, but looking at things that are impossible and trying to make them not impossible. And so the way that we go about doing it at Not Impossible is our mission is to change the world through technology and story. And the technology part, since I do come from LA, from Los Angeles, out in Venice Beach, this world of technology, I had a production company. So we did things, I made animations. You guys know the James Bond films, how those little main title sequences, it's like action adventure, the movie starts, and then it cuts to animation and naked people, and then it goes back to the film, right? So that middle part there, that's the main title. So we did things like that, and so it was technology, the world of technology was for design and technology for characters and technology for graphics and entertainment. And now the world I play in is still technology, but it's technology for the sake of humanity. And what that means is, and I'll talk a little bit about this, we look through the lens of what's absurd, what needs to change on this planet? What things do we need to change? And then we figure out, all right, how can technology serve to help change those? How do we make it and engineer it? Usually we're cracking something over, or you know, open, and using some duct tape and zip ties along the way, reprogramming, re-engineering. But then when we put it all back together, we make it so that it accomplishes a fundamental human and social need, right? And then we try to make it accessible so people can have that solution and it can help their lives. So that's what technology for the sake of humanity means. So change the world through technology and story. This other part is story. And the whole thing about story is everybody here knows how to tell a story. It's right. It's how you are taught. It's how you go to school. It's how education is passed on information. But what we do is we use story. We go out and create these crazy things, and then we use story as a way to make sure that everybody has access to it. That's how we tell these beautiful stories, and we make sure that everybody finds out about it. And so the lens that we look through when we tell this story is this lens called help one, help many. And what that means is, look, most people aren't gazillionaires, right? Most people in this room, myself included, we just, you know, we have what we have and we do with what we have. And so what we do is we use this device of story to be able to go out and try to help one person, tell the story powerfully about helping one person, and then use that as a way to spark interest and spark passion in other people so that it helps many people. Right? So if you help one person focus on that story, that has the ability to scale. That has the ability to spread like wildfire and help many people. Because you get a chance to digest it if it's about one person. So we always ask our question at the beginning of the project, who is the one? Who's that one person? If we help that one person, then maybe it could be the spark that starts the smolder, that starts the fire to help many. So that's kind of the basis of everything that I do at Not Impossible. And so in the story of Not Impossible, chapter one rolls around because my wife and I decided to go out on this date. This friend of ours came by and he took over our date and said, I'm taking you guys out. We all right. So we hopped in his car. We're driving away. We pull into where we're going to go. And I said, oh, by the way, where are we going to go? And he goes, oh, we're going to a gallery event. And I went, ugh, serious? We're going to go to a gallery event? There's going to be a bunch of adults that are walking around like this and they've got lukewarm Chardonnay in their hands and you know, they're talking about art that they really don't care about. And I was like, oh, man. And he goes, just hold on for a second. Hold on. So we walk into this place. This is not like any kind of gallery event that I've ever seen. There's loud music, and people are just taking selfies of each other, and it's like a party. And so I said, hey, what's the story? I want to meet this artist. And he said, you can't meet the artist. The artist's name is Tempt, Tony Tempt Kwan. And this is a benefit to raise money to pay for his hospital bills. He has ALS. He has Lou Gehrig's disease. And I went, oh, wow. Right? You ever been to one of those things where you're not really expecting something and all of a sudden you just, wow, I didn't see that coming. And so we went out through the night, we met some people, and then we went home. Well, as a production company, what we do is every year we would give our clients gifts, and we would give them a bottle of something or a basket of something or tickets to something. But this year, that was in springtime that we found out about Tempt. Christmas time rolls around, and we said, well, why don't we, let's just give a donation to a charity on behalf of our clients. That'd be a little more personal. So we decided, let's do it for the Tempt One Foundation. And so we gather up all of our money, and we make, Christmas time comes and goes, and we sit down in January with his father and brother who are in charge of his foundation, and we say, hey, we want to give you this money. What are you going to use the money for? And his brother says, I just want to talk to my brother again. I just want to be able to speak to him again. And I said, I'm sorry because I don't have anybody in my family with ALS, but doesn't everybody have a Stephen Hawking machine, one of those machines that someone who's paralyzed can kind of move their eyes and it controls the cursor and then the robot talks for them like this? And he said, no, man, we don't. Those things are so expensive. You can only get those if you have insurance or money, and we don't have insurance or money. We wouldn't have met you at a benefit if we had insurance or money. And I said, well, how do you guys talk? He said, we talk through a piece of paper. We hold up a piece of paper and we run our finger along it. And when our finger gets to the letter on this piece of paper that my brother wants, he blinks. And then we start again. Finger, blink, finger, letter, blink, finger, letter, blink. Letters form words, words form sentences, and eventually that's how we communicate. And I was like, wait, what? Like, that's absurd. That doesn't make any sense. I live in Los Angeles. We have a GMP greater than most developing nations in my little town, right? And 13 miles away from me, there was a guy whose brother couldn't communicate but through a piece of paper. I'm like, that's crazy. I said, all right, here's what we're going to do. I'm a father. I'm a brother. We're going to change that. I'm going to get you one of those Stephen Hawking machines. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, I just looked at the check you gave me. You don't have enough money for one of those. And I went, dude, I'm a producer. I make people do stuff they shouldn't do all the time. Don't worry. I got this. And he was like, really? I'm like, oh, yeah. So we got all fired up. And he's like, that's amazing. We're going to be able to talk to my brother again. And I went, yeah, but you know what else we're going to do? I'll tell you what, I got caught up in the moment. I'm like, let's make it so that the next time there's a benefit, that your brother's drawing. That he will figure out a way, somehow to figure out so he can draw with his eyes. And then his art can be on the wall, not other artists. He said, you can do that? And I went, come on, can I do that? Notice I never answered. And he took it as a yes. And he's like, oh, amazing. They walked out the door. And the second they walked out the door, I was like, oh man, what did I just commit to? I don't have any business doing that, but what I learned on that day and is absolutely fundamental to how we operate now, that when you see something, especially you guys, when you see something that you consider to be absurd from a human standpoint, just from a human standpoint, just doesn't seem it should be that way, that you commit and then you figure out how you're going to pull it off. Now, here's the deal. It sounds like it's like, aha, kind of flippant. I cannot tell you what a powerful way that is to live. It's about why something has to happen, not about how. If it has to happen, you'll figure out how to make it happen. So that's what I did. I invited all these brilliant people to my house. My wife and kids and I moved out. These guys moved in. We pushed all the tables and chairs against the wall. We started to hack. We started to program. We started to play with kind of how we would capture the eye. And we came up with a device called the Eye Rider. And it's a cheap pair of sunglasses from the Venice Beach Boardwalk where I live. We duct tape a wire to the side of it. We cracked open a web camera, focused it back on the pupil, and it looked like this. And so as Tempt would lay there and as he would move his eyes, it would move the cursor on the screen. And as he would blink, that was the binary act of clicking the mouse. And it was in his, we took it to his hospital room after two weeks of sleepless nights, and we gathered up all of his friends and family. We went to his hospital room. We kicked his hospital bed out so we could see down into the parking lot. We set up a computer in his room and then another computer downstairs. We hooked up a gas generator. We may or may not have broken into a used car parking lot downstairs from the hospital. And we projected on the side of a building. And then Tempt from his hospital room, projecting down to the projector in the parking lot, for the first time in 7 years, he drew again. He drew again from his family and friends. Thank you. It was awesome. It was awesome. And then we went home because we did it. And we were going to tweak it a little bit and play with it and make it a little better, but we were home. And then we woke up. We woke up and it was Time Magazine's top 50 inventions of the year. Everybody started picking up the story, calling it 8 incredible health inventions that transform lives. It's now part of the permanent collection at the MoMA in New York. I always wanted to do a TED Talk. I didn't know what heck I could talk about if I got invited to do a TED Talk. Now I got invited to do TED Talks. I had something to talk about. And we were like, holy cow, what happened? We struck a nerve here. We made something to help somebody. Maybe we should keep doing this. Nah, maybe we got lucky. And we debated and we're like, we got lucky. Let's just go back to our day jobs. And then Tempt sent us this email. And he said, that was the first time I'd drawn anything for 7 years. I feel like I've been held underwater and someone finally reached down and pulled my head up so I could take a breath. And if you're debating to or not to do something and you get an email like that, do you really have a choice? Right? And so that was the launch of Non-Impossible Labs. And we started delving into this whole concept of impossible. And here's the crazy thing, pop quiz. Name something that's possible today. Name anything that's possible today that was not impossible first. Everything that's possible today at one point was possible, or everything that's possible today at one point was impossible. So we're like, oh, this is interesting. If everything that's around us, lights and projectors and clicker things and cell phones, if all of those things at one day were impossible, but now they're possible, then maybe the inverse is true. Maybe everything that's impossible today, statistically, if you base everything on the past, everything that's impossible today is on the trajectory, statistically, of becoming what? Possible. It's just stats. It's just math. It's just data. It's just history. So we're like, oh, this is really interesting. This is a different way for us to think about life and how we approach the problems on this planet. And then we started to look at all these historical things. The four-minute mile. No one ever breaks the four-minute mile. In the history of mankind, this guy goes out and breaks it. Now everybody starts breaking it right after he does it. Hillary climbs Everest. Everyone says, you can't climb Everest, Hillary. That's impossible. Now Everest looks like a KOA campground. Right? And at one point, this was the tallest building. Now they're slightly taller buildings. And we're like, all right, so this is interesting. Everything that's possible today was impossible first. And so that means everything that's impossible today is going to become possible. And the second somebody takes the impossible to possible, it gives everybody else permission to do it. And so that's the fallacy of impossible, you guys. And the reason I want you guys to understand this is that you guys are the ones that every single day are going to take things from impossible to possible. And even if you just move that dial just a little tiny bit, you're going to give everybody else in this whole place, this whole country, this whole planet, permission to take it a little further. So it's your job to start to keep pushing things forward and moving things from impossible to possible. And that's the whole fallacy of this. All right, so now we're cruising along. We're kind of figuring some stuff out. We made this whole iWriter thing that goes big. And then I go out to dinner with a friend of mine. He's like, hey, you got to check out this guy, this doctor that I know. You got to check him out. So I go back after dinner and I check this guy out. And he's this incredible doctor. He was a naval surgeon who became a missionary doctor. And he moved to this area called the Nuba Mountains, which is between Sudan and South Sudan. And it's this war-torn area, and he's the only doctor. He's the only guy. He has to do everything, babies, operations, teeth, you name it, he has to do it. And I'm reading about this guy, and he's a very passionate man, and I'm very moved by this story. And then all of a sudden, he talks a little deeper in the story. He talks about the one thing that Dr. Tom hates to do is to perform amputations. And I'm like, well, why is Dr. Tom performing amputations? So I dig into that, and what I realize is he's having to perform amputations because the president of Sudan regularly bombs his people in the Nuba Mountains. He's trying to drive them out. And he has these old 55-gallon drums filled with jet fuel and shrapnel. He has these old Russian Antonov cargo planes. These guys roll them out of the back. They hit the ground. They make a huge crater. They spray shrapnel everywhere. They either kill them or maim people. And I'm like, whew. And then it talks a little further. I'm reading more into this story. It talks about this one particular boy named Daniel who was out tending his family's goats and cows. He was out in this open field. He heard the bombers come. He had no place to run. There was no place for him to go. But there was a tree. And so he went and he hid behind the tree. And he wrapped his arms around a tree and he closed his eyes. And the bomb went off not far from where he was. And luckily his body was behind the tree. But because his arms were around the other side, the bomb ripped off his arms. And so he finally made his way, after 8 hours, he made his way to Dr. Tom. Dr. Tom stitched him up, saved his life. And the next day when he woke up and realized that he was an armless Sudanese boy, and it's hard enough to stay alive in Sudan with your arms, the first thing he said was, "If I could die, I would." And this is the part that got me. "Because now I'm going to be such a burden to my family." And I was thinking, what? What 12-year-old boy deserves to say that? I'm like, that's absurd. I had my three kids, my three little knuckleheads were asleep not 30 feet from when I was reading this story. I'm like, all right, I don't know how, I don't know what, I don't know who, but here we go. Geronimo, same thing. I invite a bunch of brilliant people to my house, right? And when brilliant people come to my house, typically these guys are off the charts smart with questionable hygiene habits, right? Just to be clear, right? So my wife and kids are like, here we go. We got to move out of the house again. And then we start to go through and program and hack and come up with all these different ideas. And I had read a story about a carpenter who accidentally cut his fingers off, couldn't afford prosthetics. So he 3D printed fingers for himself. And I was like, aha, here we go. That's my little morsel of permission. If he can print fingers, maybe we can print hands, hands to arms. So we go through and we do all these, our entire hack fest with all these brilliant people. Totally fails, completely and totally fails. Nothing works. And so I had flown the carpenter out from South Africa, and every time he tried to help, we kind of kept pushing him to the back. And after everybody leaves, he comes up and he says, "I don't know, mate, you want to listen to me now?" And I said, "Yeah, Richard, what do you got?" And he goes, "All right, well, how about this? Let's just put aside to the fact you don't have anything that works right now. You got nothing, bupkis." He's like, "Let's just put that to the side." He said, "Don't go. Don't go to Sudan. That place is one of the nastiest places on this planet." He said, I was in the special forces in South Africa. I've seen and done things that I will never forget. He said, "I have friends who are contract special forces. They will never go to Sudan. I will never go to Sudan. And we know what we're doing. The only chance you have of not getting shot is that you are a 6'6", bald, tall, shiny white guy. And anybody, any sniper in the Sudanese army is going to see you and think, clearly this is a ploy to get me to reveal my position." That's not a comforting way to think about not getting shot. And so I said, "You know, I hear you, Richard. I hear you, but I got to go. I'm going." And he said, "Why? Why are you going?" And I said, "I bought the tickets on Expedia. They have a no refund policy on all their tickets." And he said, "I knew you were going to have a smart aleck reply like that." He said, "All right, come to South Africa and I'll train you, but you got to get your butt over there as quickly as possible." So I flew to South Africa. He wasn't lying. He doesn't sleep much. He trained me how to 3D print. He trained me how to fix things that come out of a 3D printer that don't work, which is most of the time. He taught me how to work with prosthetics and work with amputees. And at the end of this time, he said, "All right, off you go. You got it. You got to figure it out." And so I hopped on a plane. I flew into the refugee camp. And obviously, that's not the plane that I flew on in the refugee camp, right? We landed in the refugee camp. We got ready to go. Just as we were going to cross over, we wait for night to fall, and we were going to cross over 10 different checkpoints to get to Dr. Tom in the Nuba Mountains. And the SPLA, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, were going to give a safe passage from the refugee camp to Dr. Tom. And as we're getting ready to pull out, the SPLA come in and they say, "I'm sorry, you can't go. We don't know what happened. We don't know where you've been." I was learning how to make arms with Richard. That's where I was. They said, "But the ceasefire ended, and we're not taking you anymore." So I debate back and forth, and they're basically just like, "You're not going." Luckily, one of the local NGOs came over and said, "Hey, if you want, we've got a shed in the back. You can make arms here. You can make arms here, and eventually you can get up to Dr. Tom, but you got to be patient." So I said, "Done." So we went over next morning, and we set up. We started to clean up and set up and kind of go through the whole process of getting the the workshop ready. And Daniel, the boy who lost both of his arms, they found him in the refugee camp a couple months earlier. And we said, don't lose him. He's our one. So Daniel would show up every day at 9 o'clock and we would go through the process of making an arm for him and getting to know him. And he didn't speak English and I didn't speak Arabic. And we're kind of going through this whole process of learning this. And literally everything went wrong. I mean, the electricity would surge, so it would kill our prints. For those of you who know, I'm assuming most of you know how a 3D printer works. The filament, it was so hot, the filament was melting to itself before it even got into the 3D printer. So we had to work at night. It was just one thing after another. But guess what? Every morning, didn't matter if we were what went on the night before, Daniel would show up and he's like, what's up, bald guy? Where's my arm? And so on November 11th, which was exactly precisely 4 months to the day that I went out to dinner with that friend of mine and he told me the story of Dr. Tom, this happened. We need volume on this. We'll start again. This happened. And we'll go one more time. See, here's what you guys got to understand. When you go to Sudan and you have everything break, when you're standing in front of 16,000 people and a clicker and a video doesn't work, it doesn't really stress you out, right? It's not that big of a deal. All right, you guys give me a heads up. Give me like a whoop whoop backstage if you actually have the volume ready. Get that volume ready and get that computer ready. Did you guys hear whoop whoop back there? No, not you. If you say whoop whoop, they're not ready. Go? All right, here we go. Nope. Let's try again. Here we go. We got to plug in that thing in the speaker. Oh. Aha. What do you think? What do you think? I think we figured this one out. Here we go. Hey, where's drums? Drum roll, please. And then this happened.
There's this thing in me that loves to see things that are supposed to not be done, be done.
Daniel is just one of 50,000 amputees left in the wake of the bloodiest war Africa has ever known. We flew into an active war zone in Sudan with 3D printers, laptops, spools of plastic, and the goal to build Daniel an arm.
You ready?
The concept of Project Daniel was hatched on July 11th. And on November 11th, Daniel fed himself for the first time in 2 years. But it's never about just one person. If we could teach the locals to do it themselves, then Project Daniel could live on long after we left. And it did.
Thank you, guys. All right, be honest. Are you cheering because we made a device to have Daniel feed himself for the first time in 2 years, or are you cheering because the volume worked? Both? All right, deal. Fair enough. So we came back, and we're like, all right, change the world through technology and story, and we took this story out, and the story went crazy. Everybody started talking about this thing. Everybody picked up the story. We started winning all these crazy awards, and here's the point. We didn't care about the awards, but now I can sit in front of you. I can sit in front of Fortune 500 companies and have this whole conversation about doing good. And here's the thing. As the people who represent the future, this is what I want you guys to take away, is that doing good, this whole concept of doing good, it's good branding for your businesses. It's good growth for your businesses. It's good recruiting. It's good retaining for people. Doing good ultimately is good business. There is droves and droves and droves of studies that prove this. So as you guys go out into the world and create your future businesses, remember that if you bake this concept of doing good into what you do, it is actually good for your business. It's called enlightened capitalism. You do things that are good for your world, for your community, and for your society, it's actually good for your business. And that's the whole non-impossible movement. That's what we're all about, is igniting this group of people. This is how we make our country great. This is how we make our world great, by each and every one of you going out and doing something good for the world, and you guys solving the social issues in our country. That's how we make change. So we're working on a bunch of other stuff right now. There's a project. After I came back from Project Daniel, I got invited to a hospital in Mexico City. Can you bring the volume down on that? Now the volume works. They took me and they showed me this massive pediatric hospital, right? And they took me and they showed me this, and they said that this little girl has cerebral palsy, and if she uses this machine consistently and consecutively for a year, this little girl, who's destined to never walk without a walker or a crutch, will go from having to walk with an aid to being able to walk unaided. And I went, what? That's crazy. That's a miracle machine. He said, yeah. And I said, sir, excuse me, but your hospital is so big. Why don't you have, this should look like the Stairmaster floor in these big gyms, you know what I mean, with people just boogieing on these things all the time. And he said, we'd love to have more. We can't afford them. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, these things are $500,000 each. And I went, what? That's crazy. And so I looked at it, and I kind of came up with some ideas, and I went, sir, what if I could make this for you for a fifth of the price? And he said, I would buy 20 of them from you right now. And I said, I will be right back. And so we went back and we started looking at this, and this was absurd. There's a device that can help kids walk, but kids can't get on it because they're so expensive that people can't get to it. So we again brought a big group of people together to brainstorm stuff. Guess who solved the problem? We had probably, what I guess is probably $2 million worth of school loans for PhDs and doctors around the table trying to solve this thing. Guess who solved the problem? Our intern, right there in the middle, and his high school robotics team, they solved it. We partnered with a massive automobile company. Now we're creating the future of rehabilitation. It is better. It is faster. It is stronger. Kids don't think of it as rehab. They think of it as going to play video games. And because we partnered with an automobile company, guess what? First of all, this thing ain't going to break down because you just got to give it an oil and lube job, and it's going to keep running forever. So there goes the maintenance contract. But if this does break down, guess what? It's made of 90% off-the-shelf automobile parts. You need this thing. If this thing breaks down for some reason, you just go to the dealership or the auto parts store to get it fixed. If you're in rural Tibet or China and it breaks down and you can't get to an auto parts store, if it's my son or daughter and they need to walk and that thing's not working, go steal a car. But the official position on Impossible is don't steal the whole car, just steal the part, because it's wasteful if you steal the whole car. So music, not impossible. I get infatuated with the way things work, and especially the way the body works, and I'm a skateboarder, right? And so I was out skateboarding. You can take the volume down on this.
How would you describe yourself?
And a friend of mine fell, and he hit the back of his head, and he lost his sense of smell. And I was like, well, wait a second. If he fell on his head and lost his sense of smell, then maybe there's a way for us to get around this whole thing of hearing. And maybe hearing, you don't hear through your ears, or you don't smell through your nose, it's through your head. So maybe we can just get around the eardrums and go straight to the brain. Let's figure out how we can actually go take music for the deaf and go straight to the brain. And so we came up with a system that takes music signals, and then the drums would go to your ankles, the guitars would go to your wrists, the vocals would go to your chest, the bass to the base of your spine, and it would project that so someone who is deaf could sit there and they could feel the music on different parts of their body, and that's essentially the translation that your ears do in sending the signal to the brain. Now we're basically churning the skin into the eardrum. And so we took it out, we showed it to the deaf community, and the deaf community threatened us. And they said, "We're not giving this back." And we were like, "Holy cow, this is incredible." So we took it out and we took it to different places and we started demoing it around the world. And then we got a chance to meet this girl. You guys know this girl? So she came over to the office, and little did I know that she had a future. She was going to go on to America's Got Talent, take fourth place, win the golden buzzer. And so she got a chance to experience this. And I think, I don't know. Oh, great. Hey, Mandy. Yeah. You guys know Mandy?
Hi, guys. I wanted to play a little song for you, if that's okay. Like you have a choice. The message Mick is telling you is that you have to commit. Commit first, and then we'll figure it out. Every step of my career after losing my hearing has been one commitment after another. Terrifying, terrifying commitments that have made such fun impacts not only on my life, but on so many others. And I want to ask you a simple question, a very weighty question. But are you ready to commit? Commit to change the world. Commit to make things better. And if yes, let's do this together. So I will.
Come on, is that amazing or what? Hold on, hold on, hold on. Keep the lights up, please. Just so you guys know, that was arranged about 8 hours ago. I was texting Mandy, and she's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm on a plane. I'm so psyched. I'll get to go speak to FFA tomorrow. And she's like, where's that? I said, Indianapolis. And she goes, dot, dot, dot. That's where I'm going, too. So she's here today. So here's the crazy thing. So we did this thing for the deaf. All of a sudden, the hearing community started going, holy cow, this is amazing. We love this thing. You guys heard of this person? She kind of liked it too, right? And then when our chief mad scientist said, hey, I have this theory. Will you give it to me? I know this famous jazz pianist, and I actually want to, I actually think this might work. He's got Parkinson's, and maybe there's something this wristband can do for him. So he took it over. Whoop. Uh-oh. Remind me later. All right, that's a screenshot of Mandy. That's a screenshot of Mandy. Oh, no, no. Hang on, guys. Remember I told you? If your 3D printers break in Sudan, you don't really care about stuff like this. Woo! All right. And so we took it over. There's the chief mad scientist. And he said, hey, I got this friend of mine who's a pianist. You got to check him out. He's got Parkinson's. Look at his handshake. And he says, I think what
See
I want
that?
To bring the volume down a little bit, please.
Yep.
He said, what I want to do is I want to put your wristband on it because it vibrates, and I have this theory, maybe, just maybe, we can stop his Parkinson's. And so you can see how hard it is for him to actually use his fingers.
So that's much harder for you.
Yeah.
And so we put on our wristbands. He's 83 years old. He's a jazz, like, famous, famous pianist. He hasn't played the piano for years. We put on our wristband.
No.
You got light?
Yep, this is perfect.
It stopped his tremors because of Parkinson's.
Tap each finger.
Completely. You could bring the volume down. It stopped it completely. And we were like, that's pretty cool. We just wanted to make a device to help the deaf experience music, and looks like we just caused a non-pharmaceutical remedy to tremors caused by Parkinson's. So here's the punchline, guys. Here's the punchline. Did we mean for that to happen? No. But what did we do? We committed to something, and great things happen when you commit. So now we're in clinical trials. Oh, my gosh. There we go. Hang on. We're in clinical trials at Mount Sinai right now. And I say this to you guys right now because I guarantee there's people in this room who have loved ones or know people with Parkinson's. Send us an email to info@NotImpossibleLabs. If you have someone with Parkinson's and you want to get them in a trial, get their butts out to Mount Sinai in New York, and we'll get them in this trial. Get them out there, and we'll put them in the trial. So here's the punchline. You guys ready for this? Here's the punchline. Do you know why we pull all this off? You ready? I'm going to drop mad knowledge on you guys right now. Here it comes. Do you know why we pull it off? Because we shouldn't. We don't have the degrees. We don't have the credentials. We don't know what the heck we're doing half the time. Half the time. The majority of the time, we don't know what we're doing. But the reason we succeed in this, and I write about this, is that we operate from this point of beautiful, limitless naivete. We didn't get the memo that we're not supposed to be able to do it, so we just go do it. And we commit, we find our one, and then we just say Geronimo. So I want to leave you guys with one of my favorite quotes in the world by Horace Mann, which is, refuse to die until you have won some victory for humanity. Doesn't get any clearer than that. Refuse to die. Refuse to die until you've done something good for this planet. If you've done something good for the planet, you can go. If you haven't, you got to stick around for a couple more minutes. So here's the question that I have for you guys. What's your victory? You guys are here because you're already... Am I safe in saying that if you're in this room, you're already a badass? All right, so we've established that. We've established that as the baseline. So now what's your victory going to be? What's the story that your kids are going to tell about you? That your friends and family are going to tell about you? And in the whole concept of all the stuff I've been talking to you guys about today, the question I have in that whole premise of help one, help many, I want to ask you guys this, is who is your one? Who's that one person that if you were to just try to help them in some way, to make something or do something for them, could be in your school, could be in your team, could be anybody. You could drive by them every day. But what would happen? What would happen if every single one of you right now went back to wherever you're from and helped one person? Do you see the tidal wave that that could cause on this, in this country and in your communities? So the question I have for you guys is, who is your one? Or in the concept of all the stuff I've talked to you guys about today, who is your Daniel? Who is your Daniel? Thank you guys very much.